Well, hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 62 of Making It Women in Film, a podcast where I sit down with women working across the film and TV industry to learn their story and hear all about their craft, career, and vigorous resilience. My name is Avita, and I'm so excited to bring this week's episode, produced by Bonnie and Bra and Nellis Films, to you. Today, I spoke with Carmen Thompson, a film curator and creative producer working with distribution and community engagement. I loved listening to Carmen's story and experiences, and I'm sure you will too. Now, if you stay tuned to the end of the interview, Lauren and I also have another roundtable segment for you. We wanted to expand a bit more on the topic of representation as we spoke on last week, so we dove into the representation of love and diversity of and in love on screen. That'll be the last half hour of the show. Now also, just a quick note, the audio in the first hour here isn't perfect, but I hope you can see, listen through that and still enjoy it for its content. Without further ado, here is Carmen.
So I'm a curator, programmer, producer, bit of everything, film exhibition, distribution-wise, based in Edinburgh in Scotland.
Yes, great. Yes, we'll get into all the details, you know. But that's good. You've had a very interesting career journey, and we're going to get into all of that. But I'm curious to know where you think this began. What was five-year-old Carmen up to?
Five-year-old Carmen. So I grew up in Nairobi, in Kenya. And five-year-old me was outside. Ironically, it's really weird. I had a childhood that was not really very full of film. I didn't watch a lot of television. We didn't have access to a lot of films. So yeah, I was just like outside in the mud. Yeah, like reading books. But yeah, very much just like very, very much outdoors, not looking at screens. So it wasn't until we moved to the UK that world really opened up for me. But yeah, I always think about that. Like a lot of people talk about like film right from a young age. And we went to the cinema and things, but it definitely wasn't central to my life when I was really, really young.
Yeah. Do you remember what the first movie you saw was?
Oh, do I remember what the first movie I saw was? I don't know, but there's like a few films that like are just floating around my brain from my childhood, and mainly just because my mum is obsessed with musicals, so something that we would watch all the time, and definitely like The Sound of Music, or like West Side Story, and then maybe some of the like early sort of Disney films that had music in them, like The Lion King was a very big part of my childhood, and like The Jungle Book. But generally, I don't know. This is getting off on a massive tangent, but I'm slightly worried about my memory. I don't have like huge, I feel like I don't have a huge like grasp of like the linear passage of time in my childhood. It's like a lot of like memories like dotted around, and I can't really place them in the like timeline of my life. But yeah, those were like the sort of things, definitely like my first experiences of watching film with my family would have been musicals for sure, because my mom is like low-key like obsessed with them.
No, that's interesting, because I do feel like, you know, some people have very vivid memories of like their first interactions with film and that, and for me, I just remember being in the parking lot after watching Babe. That's all. I don't remember actually watching Babe. But I just remember being in the parking lot with my grandparents, you know, so there's just those strange moments.
This is actually I've had this really weird memory that's just like popped into my mind, and it's definitely not in the UK, because for sure like it came like suddenly when I came to the UK. It was like overwhelming, like the amount of films I had access to and like how incredible it was. I was like opened up to this new world. I've just had this weird vivid memory of being at one of these like, you know, there's like summer camps where you like go and stay and you do like zip wires and stuff like that. I don't think it was in like Taunton or something. I moved to Bristol when we moved to the UK. Yes. And one night we went to the cinema and we saw Pirates of the Caribbean. Like everybody like loved it. I came out of it and I was like, I had this like overwhelming feeling. This is like, maybe I'm getting like too deep here, but I was like, I got so sad. I had this feeling of enjoying it so much to the point that I was like, I'm so overwhelmed and sad that I wasn't like part of it. I think there was like a feeling of like, this is like so incredible, like this world is so insane to me, and I'm like, I want to like be part of it, and I don't, and it feels like so far away from me. And I came out and I was like so overwhelmed by this like sadness that like I would never ever get to like, it wasn't like the film, it was like I was watching the film, like this would have been amazing to shoot. I had this like sort of, you know, like the ships and like the islands and like the scale of the like the production. I think of that feeling, I was like, oh my God, imagine what it would be like to like, be part of making this. And then it like immediately gets followed by a sadness that like I'll just never be able to do it because, and well, I think we'll go on to that, like film for a really long time was like, I loved it, but like felt like this like alien thing that like people in my world like would just never ever be able to like think about working in. And I think that's weird. Like, that's the first time I've ever really remembered that memory. Wow. But, like, I think maybe that was, like, the first time that I really felt it. Of, like, oh, my God, I love this thing. But it's, like, so, like, inaccessible to me. That's so weird. I don't know what babe and a party like, got me there. But that's so funny. I haven't thought about it in ages. Like, I think I was nearly crying. My mum was, like, I think maybe I didn't even have the words for it. My mum was, like, why are you sad? Like, I was just, like, it was like so such a weird response to have like coming out of the film.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are some movies that just consume you so much, you know, and especially as a child where you're so impressionable as well and everything, you know, every story just comes alive. You don't have critical thinking skills and you can't really see through the, you know, the plot holes and everything. And it's just, I mean, the amount of times I remember running through the woods and like mentally role playing as a type of character, you know, it's just, it lives with you, it lives through you. So that's interesting, kind of coming to the UK and having this new world opened up to you. Obviously, clearly that was one of the movies that kind of did something. What else was it about kind of this new media that really spoke to you? I mean, I'm sure it was kind of overwhelming as well a little bit. And also, you know, it was in the UK, which is a very different culture and different audience that they're playing to. How did that feel?
Oh my gosh, I have so many feelings about this. It was like really formative, I think, for me in all aspects of my life, but certainly like how I think about film and the role of like media in my life. There's so many different elements to it. I think one of them, you know, like having television that plays stuff all the time and like having access to media all the time. It was when we moved to the UK, it was about the time of like the introduction of like, I remember my mum getting a mobile phone. The internet was becoming bigger. It makes me sound like 100 years old. These like, this like new tech. I remember my dad got a camcorder that he could record stuff. Still, it still seemed like further away, but I was like, okay, I have access to like some of these things. This like space isn't impenetrable to me. But at the same time, I found the move like quite overwhelming in terms of media, in terms of representation. I speak about this quite a lot, where I'd come from, Kenya, but also just like the African continent more broadly, because like that's how it's positioned here in the UK, as like one whole place. The way that it was represented in various media, and also just like how like people that look like me, like Black people, either not represented or how they were when they were represented, was like so weird to me. Like I was like forced to become like aware of all these kind of structures and processes just because like my reality didn't match with like what people were being told, and the way people interacted with me and spoke to me about myself, about where I'd come from, as a direct result was the way that they'd seen those places and those people like represented. So like I found it quite, it had quite a lot of like weird and like quite, you know, like I like when I look back, quite like not traumatic, but quite like, you know, difficult conversations with friends who like their idea about where I'd grown up and like the questions they asked me in response to that, like, do you know, did you live in a mud hut, like did you have electricity, like all these questions that I was like, where is this coming from? And then I started watching TV and like watching the news and watching films, and I was like, oh, I understand. So I just became hyper aware of like all these things at the same time. And perhaps most importantly, and I think that's something that stayed in me for so long, is like how media can really like affect society and how it shapes people's views, but also how as a person consuming media, as I've gone on to see myself represented or see myself in films, like what that means, how a lot of people take that for granted. And yeah, and having a reality on screen that feels resident to their own lived experience, I think is something that for a long time a certain group of people have really taken for granted and don't understand what it's like to like not have that.
Definitely. Yeah. That's must have been quite a shock to the system in a way. obviously, I know you kind of went into a very different route at first, academically, as to physics. But before you went into that, was there like a part of you that wanted to have a role in arts?
Oh my God. All the time, just not as a vocation, I think. Just because it wouldn't even have crossed my mind. If I thought it was accessible, that's all I would have been thinking of. But to me, like the school I went to, the people I was around, the conversations, I think just genuinely, I think that degrees like film curation, for example, just actually didn't exist. Like, certainly not like on, you know, in the scale that they are now in different universities. So like, it just didn't seem to me to be an option. They see my love of film, which was there and like only grew throughout my childhood and as I grew up and also when I was at university, seemed like a separate thing to like what I was going to do at university and like what was I going to do as a job. Like, it always seemed like something I'd have to do alongside that. But it was always there. Like I said, like I would my dad had this camcorder, like my whole childhood I would like be filming everything. I'd like force my family to like star in films I wrote. It was it was intense. I literally film like everything, and I think maybe like part of me is like that's where my interest in like documentary came from, because I was just like always filming like the world that I had saw around me. And then I was lit, like I was just, if I wasn't, I was quite a nerdy child. I loved school, so I went home and I did my homework. I didn't like have this huge like social like life and go out and do, you know, I that all came in when I went to university. But the rest of the time, if I wasn't like doing homework, I was like at Blockbuster on the weekends, like taking out like 5 really obscure like indie films, like really strange, like quirky films, like not, and just watching those like obsessively. So that was like, those things were happening simultaneously. So it was in my mind in a way, but like never just, it never even occurred to me like, oh, do film at university. Like, it would have been, yeah, it was strange.
And so you did get your bachelor's in astrophysics. And then what happened? Because there was a turn and you decided that this was maybe something that could be a vocation. When did you realize that this was something you could do? And what happened after that?
I think once I got to university and I realized like what other people were doing. But also as I got out into the world, I moved to London. Like, I just got a sense of the city and like the kind of jobs that were around. I don't know, like you just sort of like you're walking around the streets and you like see, you know, see signs of like production companies. And I went to university in Bloomsbury. It was very close to Soho, which is actually where I ended up working, because there's like a lot of huge production companies and post-production companies. Soho is like the central hub of that. Like, I started going to like, you know, and you can get like free tickets to go to TV recordings and stuff. I think it was just like being out in the world and like understanding, okay, these things are like, again, like further in, like closer to me than I think they are. And I was originally meant to do like a 4-year like master's, bachelor's degree. So there was a point like when I got to the end of my third year where we could give up, and I was like, I just got to the end of it. I love space. I love like astronomy. But I think it's one of those things where like you get too close to it and it just like sucks all the like wonder and joy out of it. And I just, it become aware that like all the like career paths that were being spoken about that came off, you know, the offshoots of that, people ended up going to investment banking or like working in research. Like, none of those like appeal to me on any sort of level. So yeah, so I quit after 3 years, got the bachelor's. Yeah, then I was just like, I'm just going to start applying to be like, to do like these low level jobs, you know, like runners or like internships in like, I just sent millions of letters to like, I just searched the internet for like any sort of place.
How long do you think it actually took from you sending like your first application to getting that first interview?
It was about the whole summer after I graduated, I was sending messages. Then I did this, like, I did a month, like free internship at this, production company studio called Silverfish, which they did a lot of like corporate work, and they worked with like sort of non like NGOs and stuff, making like a lot of like documentary and like media work. They were like lovely, and I really was able to get like hands-on in like all sort of elements of that. And then it was like I'd stayed there for a month, they'd invite me to stay another month, and then I got the call for NPC and ended up getting it, so I had to leave that day. Just because I had no money. So yeah, it was quite a long slog. It was, you know, for, yeah, 3 or 4 months or something, 5 months of like not having any, you know, not being paid. And just like I had some really lovely friends from my course who did immediately go into like very well paid jobs in investment banking, who were able to like house me. And like I was just slept on their sofas on the floor and stuff while I was looking for jobs. So I feel very lucky that, yeah, that happened. Otherwise it's just not accessible for so many people.
So yeah, wow, that's quite a turn of events. When you did start to get into it, when you got your first job, what did it feel like? Was it kind of like a deep down in your bones type of dream, or what was the realization like when you actually came into it?
It was quite overwhelming. And especially that the scale of MPC, which is there's this big visual effects company that I ended up working for, and they were working on films like Harry Potter movies and like Prometheus and stuff like that. So it was like these huge like studio films were like being made in this place, and it was just like really like exciting time for me. And I met so many people on a practical level. Like as a runner, I was literally just like making people coffees and like cleaning mugs like 4 hours a day of like the thousands of employees that worked in the studio. But I also just saw that as an opportunity to like it was really exciting for me because I think I love to be in a space where I'm like learning, yeah, and gaining knowledge. And I think the shift from I'd really got everywhere I could with astrophysics. Not like I knew everything about it, but I'd lost interest in it. And I was at capacity with that. So like moving to this different space, which was also quite like technical and quite scientific. So it's like it did appeal to that side of my brain. And I had some of the skills from my university to like go a step further, I think, than some of the other runners who perhaps had come from like film backgrounds, and they had more of an understanding of like how the industry worked. Like I would be able to go around to the artists, look at the like, I don't know, the programs they were using and like sort of like understand like how they were building these like 3D models and stuff like that. So it was just exciting. It was just had access to all this stuff, and I just sort of just went around and asked loads of people questions and just tried to like get as holistic an understanding as I could of like this one sort of like part of the film industry.
Yeah, that was probably helpful, especially, I think making a jump, a lot of people are afraid when they don't feel like they have an expertise in something and they go into a field where a lot of people, as you were talking about before, have been wanting to do this job since they were like 3 years old, and it can be quite intimidating to then, work alongside those people who will quote every single thing in Tarantino movies, like that kind of competition almost. But yeah, that is interesting. I think there's something important, to take from every experience.
I think about that a lot as well, because I think a lot of people can feel like imposters, because for example I did for a long time, because I didn't have that dream from when I was younger. But I think we also have to remember, and it's like sort of what I was saying, that some people like are able to have that dream because the environment that they grow up in like gives that them as an option to dream. So it's not that your dreams are less valid because you've had them for less time, I mean. It's just that it took you longer to realize that those were accessible to you, or that those were things you could dream about, because up until that point, whatever reason, the world around you didn't tell you that was a dream that you could have. So I think, yeah, it's really, really important to like not be intimidated by
Exactly.
that. And I say that having been intimidated by that. I'm not saying it's an easy thing to do, but I go back to that all the time, actually, because I feel that all the time. There's a lot of people that I feel like maybe there's a level of like them having to like justify their own existence in a space, but they do that by trying to like put you down or trying to like exclude you by sort of like showing off this like this knowledge or whatever it is that they have about space, or this historical whatever, these like canons and these things that people quote. And I think it'd be quite difficult to not be intimidated by that. But I think it's important because it's not just to do with like they've got like a deeper love or passion for it. It's to do with their own journey with it.
Exactly. And it's never too late either. It's never too late either. And I do think a lot of people regret that they didn't do something sooner rather than later. But again, as you said, you know, that means that you just have a different insight from a completely different perspective. If you did get, you know, your first degree in something that has absolutely nothing to do with film, that doesn't mean that that was useless or that you wasted time or that you should have gone into it. Because I do think, like, you know, we're pressured to make such impactful decisions in our life very, very young. And, you know, if the world was run by the way 18-year-olds think, it's very limiting to put yourself in the box that you decided to go into, like, you know, when you were 17, 18. It's free yourself of it, you know, do explore it. And so you got into being a runner. That's quite interesting and very hands-on and definitely not where you are now. But what has stayed with you from that experience?
What has stayed with me? I think a real, like, deep and visceral appreciation for how people at the bottom of all chains are, like, treated. And I think you can tell the people in the industry who have had experience of that. Sometimes people have done that and then they've somehow forgotten. You know, it's like, it's that thing of, like, who, when you're, like, you know, I don't know, on a date or something and, like, people are mean to, like, wait staff. It's like, to me, it's like a, you know, it's like an off-putter. I think because having been a runner and having been surrounded by so many other runners, the majority of these people are, like, highly skilled. Like, the majority of runners, like, I felt like a fraud again because I hadn't come from a film background. Most of these people had, like, had 4 years of, like, visual effects, you know, degree training and were, like, you know, able to do stuff, do the work themselves. But the this runner position was just a kind of a means to get to that next level. So I think certainly I don't ever want to be at a point in my career or, like, in a space where I feel like I can treat people the way that many people treated me during that time. I think having a job like that where it is like, you know, you are doing quite sort of, like, quote unquote menial tasks, but, like, you're really like across, like, the entire business, and I think you really get a wider sense of, like, how a company, like, actually works on a, like, a day-to-day basis in a way that if you just sort of slot in at a high level in a specific department, you perhaps will never understand, like, how different departments connect to each other and yet how things actually sort of run. Yeah, it's an appreciation of people in those equivalent positions, like, across our industry. And also, like, looking back now, I say, you know, with rose-tinted glasses, like, how wonderful, incredible it was, but I was being paid absolutely nothing, and working, like, insane hours, because the company was open 24 hours, and there would always have to be a runner there. So we did these, you know, every 6 weeks or something, we'd do a night shift where we worked from 11 until 7 in the morning for an entire week. You know, for what, you know, it was, I don't even know if it was a minimum wage at that time, if it was even a requirement for people to pay that, you know, but it was nothing at all. And a lot of, like, physical tasks, and there are people doing that everywhere, and there's also people, I mean, that was at least a salaried role. There's people doing the equivalent for free, you know, in the form of, like, internships and traineeships, and they should be thankful for the very, you know, for the very opportunity of being able to be in that space. So there's a real problem, I think, because I think those people, like, literally hold the industry up in all levels. Like, it goes to, like, you know, for example, like, definitely, volunteers. Definitely. I now work in programming and film festivals. Volunteers at programming at film festivals. Film festivals wouldn't exist without
exactly.
People giving their time for free or for next to nothing. And I think it's a real problem.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah, if you got every runner to quit and every volunteer to quit, nothing would go on, you know? Imagine that.
And there's just this huge disparity. There's huge, because there's a huge, I mean, this industry makes so much money. And people at the top, supposed top, I don't even want to call it the top because there isn't a hierarchy. They're doing less than the people below them. There's such a chasm between the owners and the VPs and the producers and the EPs of all these companies and runners, you know, interns, those, like, assistants. Level people, and I think it's a real issue, and it's something that, yeah, just will, I think, will always stick with me because of having done it.
And then the kind of next step on your route was marketing, and I do think marketing within film is a really interesting part because, you know, that is where our first impressions come from, It's where interests and excitement is sparked, or where it is not, where controversy happens, or if something goes completely under the radar. As a curator, as somebody working in distribution and exhibition, striving to bring movies to people, what effect do you see marketing having on audiences, for good and bad?
Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, I teach marketing a lot, and sometimes I feel hyperbolic, but also at the same time, I just don't think I am. I think it's everything. Like you said, it's literally everything. There's no point in making a film if your audience is not going to see it, or whoever audience you want to see it sees it, or if nobody sees it. I mean, maybe people think there are, but for me, I'm audience-led completely in everything I do. I don't think there's a point in making work that is not for an audience, or doesn't have an audience in your mind at all, like in some sense. And like you say, audiences consume films through marketing. Like, that's the only... And I think for some reason it has maybe like a negative undertone. And I think, you know, a lot of like these huge institutions which are like using marketing for bad, like, you know, the Facebooks of the world and all this, you know, all the sinister stuff that can happen behind these huge marketing machines. But at its very like core, it's just telling an audience about something and like giving them a route in, or like access to it, making them understand why it is that they should respond to it. And to me, that's at the center of literally everything that we're doing as an industry, but certainly like what I'm doing in terms of exhibition and distribution. And I think, like you say, it can really affect the journey of a film, how it's marketed, but also the level to which people invest in marketing and publicity, because it often comes as an afterthought. And I feel really lucky that I've had marketing in my history, because it feeds into everything I do. Everything as I'm programming, I'm thinking about how I'm going to talk to audiences about it. It's difficult for me to separate curation and marketing in my brain, because they're the same thing. I wish there was like a word that encompassed both of them. Films, and often a lot of films that I work with, they need care and time and resources put into marketing them, for a whole host of reasons, mainly to do with like our industry and how they've historically been positioned, but also how the audiences that they are speaking to are not audiences that have been historically like presented in any way. So you have to, if you're trying to cultivate a new audience or get an audience that have never been into a space before, or have never engaged with like this kind of cinema before, because either they didn't know it was there, or they've been made to feel like it isn't for them, then you have to invest time in that marketing and make them, you know, and cultivate that audience and make them understand. And I think that a lot of films are not given those resources, and the industry or the venue or whatever it is then assume that that's because the film isn't worth it, or the film doesn't have appeal or whatever it is, when in fact all it is that they haven't taken that time to market it. Exactly. Think about marketing.
Exactly. Yeah, because I mean, how many horribly poorly made movies get like, you know, millions and millions of views just because, you know, they knew how to make the right copy, you know, it's so...
Well, just the budget.
Yeah, like, the budget as well.
Film, yeah. On the side of a bus, on the inside of a tube, on like every single social media ad, like everyone's posting about it. It doesn't even matter it's just the rule of like numbers. Mm-hmm. Like, you'll just go see it because it's like, and if it's, you know, if it's showing 10 times a day, exactly, every cinema around you, like
if it is the only movie being shown, yes, like for the entire weekend.
Like, yeah, exactly. Well, you're like, this is terrible, but they've got you in and you've bought a ticket, and that's all that matters.
Exactly.
That's all that matters to the industry and the funding.
Yeah.
Get that number.
Uh-huh.
And most of the time, that's why these people have like really incredible like first weeks, because everybody goes to see it, but nobody's had a chance to tell
anything. And then it drops off, yeah.
And then that's it, but then it doesn't matter because they've got all the money. Exactly. And they've got everybody in this first week anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, it doesn't matter if they use PR to, you know, create hype about certain representation that was never there, you know, as long as people go to watch it. Yeah. It's so tricky, especially for indie filmmakers, because filmmaking is already so expensive. Like, films cost so much money to make, and then you've got the film, and then you have to spend so much money to get it out there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is really difficult. But as you said, like, integral, it is, marketing is movies. It just is.
Yeah.
It just is, for good and bad. Are there any specific movies that you've worked on where you've seen that you've really had to do this audience work to get it out there? Any examples you can give?
Every single film that I work on. And yeah, with the risk of going on another rant, it's because I think especially in distributors, we could just talk about the distribution. The films that I've worked on, for example, we worked on a Kenyan film back in 2018-19 called Rafiki. It is a beautiful, beautiful film. And many other films since. And then most recently, we're currently in the middle of a release of a film called The Gravedigger's Wife, which has been at the cinemas. And what we've experienced is the venues that we're putting this on, and it's sort of like what I was alluding to earlier, just look to us 100% to do the marketing. So, you know, where they're like tweeting again three times a day about whatever film it is, Black Adam, that was a film that was out at the same time as us, The Rock, you know, which I would argue doesn't need extra marketing anyway. They wouldn't even tweet about us. I created a huge marketing deck, for example, with The Gravedigger's Wife, with all these like different ways, giving venues as much access to the kind of audiences and networks that we establish as a distributor, giving them the language, you know, writing tweets, giving them all these different routes into like how they can market the film, links to like community groups in their local areas. Because, you know, like as a distributor, there's two of us. So we literally physically don't have the resources to do this for every single venue. If you're trying to do a wide release, you can't like tell people in like 10 cities in one day, you know, to go and see a film like with two people. You can't. You need venues to do that work. And we're just not seeing them do that work. And I think, yeah, like I said, it's for a lot of different reasons. I understand that independent cinemas also have an issue of limited resources. They don't have huge marketing teams, but I think it's like I would like to see a recognition that of and a prioritization of films that perhaps need that extra time and resources put into marketing, especially if that venue or that space has not historically been a place that the audiences that this film speaks to have come. Which is we see in a lot of like independent, especially sort of art house cinemas, they have a very specific audience, and it isn't very diverse, it isn't very inclusive, it's quite exclusionary. So if you're trying to get those audiences in, then you have to put that time in. And that's all the films I work for. And for example, like with an organization like We Are Parable, they've spent years and years cultivating these audiences. And speaking to these audiences and gaining trust from these audiences. And that's why there's a whole host of reasons, and they're incredible what they do, but why venues and other exhibitors are like looking to them, studios, to do the work of marketing, because they already established work with their audiences, and it's an easy way of not having to do the work themselves, essentially. So yeah, I'm disappointed perpetually by the lack of marketing resources and time put into, and I'll say, yeah, specifically like films by Black filmmakers. I work with a lot of cinema from the African continent, like these independent films in those kind of two spaces are just like continuously like under-resourced. And therefore, like I said, I'm not given the chance, because we, you know, the response, I'm in cinemas with audiences, packed cinemas, sold out cinemas with audiences. And there was like a lot, you know, these films are incredible, and they deserve people, you know, to be seen. And even just with The Gravedigger's Wife, the amount of feedback we've had from audiences that like didn't know it was on in their town and they've missed it. And you think that's such a shame, like it's one independent cinema in their city and they didn't know that, and some of them have been waiting for this film to come out for a year. And you know, we feel like as a distributor, as exhibitors, I feel like a pressure to make sure, and you know, a responsibility, probably the better word, to like make sure that people that you know that have been like dying to see it, and that this film is meaningful for, have a chance to see it. And it feels like so disappointing and like so saddening when we get that response that people would have gone to see it in a heartbeat if they'd known, and they just didn't know. And you think about why, where is this disconnect? Like, how can we kind of close these gaps?
So working with those types of movies, what has been the most impactful moment, the most impactful response you've gotten from audiences?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I know it's like very recent because we're in it, but the response to The Gravedigger's Wife has been unlike anything I've ever experienced in my entire career. And it's been like the most beautiful and like humbling experience being in cinemas with audiences. I just feel it's at a time where there's so much going on in our industry and I'm feeling so despondent with so many aspects of it, it really like replenished my soul and really like just made me feel like this incredible, I just feel so lucky to be able to do what I do. And yeah, perhaps to give you a little bit of context, like the film is the first Somali language film, feature film, to ever be released in cinemas. And it's hard for us to say, but like fairly sure the first Somali film, feature film, like ever made. I mean, it's just like it's unimaginable for me what that means in terms of representation for huge portions of the globe. But obviously in the context here, that, you know, the Somali diaspora here in the UK. And like I said, people have been waiting for this film because like when it premiered in Cannes back last year, and as it's kind of been released in various places across the world, like people have been waiting for it to come here. It had two screenings at London Film Festival. They were both sold out. So, you know, there's huge portions of the Somali diaspora community that went to London Film Festival, you know, to the BFI South Bank. These are like spaces, like I've said, that are not historically been for them because of the film. So people waiting for it, and we started our release with the Q&A tour with Kader Idris Ahmed and Omar Abdi, the director and the lead actor, and just the response of audiences was just incredible. And it's just that feeling that obviously I got some sense of as I've been growing up and seeing myself in films, but to the next level. So we had, you know, all generations from the community, like I said, people that have, we have to do the stupid like audience feedback forms, which is a whole other conversation, but it's always got a question around like, have you been to a screening in this space before? Huge percentages of people that have never been into these venues before, so it's bringing new people into venues, and yeah, just to watch audiences see themselves on screen and to interact with the director and the writer. Be able to watch films without reading subtitles, you know, which is just like something, again, I just don't think as English language speakers, we like, was first, you know, as our first language, like can ever understand. Like I got some sense of it by being, you know, by being in the audience and being witness to that, but I just can't, you know, I can't comprehend what that experience is like. And it's just like, you know, it's just why I want to, it makes all of the, you know, all of the kind of issues and all these frustrations around how much further it could be. Like you still have those moments, like, you know, for however big, we only have the resources that we have. We only had the money that we have. We only had the time that we had. We put everything, all of our time and energy into it. So it could always have been bigger. But when you're in those moments with audiences, you realize like, even if it was just this moment, you know, we had a sold out screening in Birmingham, for example, 150 people. It was magical. Like if it had just been that, even that's worth it. If you can make one person in an audience feel seen in a way that they've never felt seen before on film, like that's just why we do it. And I think even though we had the numbers, I think overall as an industry, we have to perhaps think about other sort of markers of like value. And like, I know there isn't a way that you can sort of like quantify that, but like to me, there's more value in getting one person in hasn't been to a space that sees themselves represented, whatever it is, and like, you know, 40 people that are always in that cinema, like always coming in and like, you know, that are watching and seeing themselves in it, you know, 90% of films that get major releases. to cut a long story short, this release has been like, yeah, just been indescribable, and I will honestly, I'll remember it for the rest of my life. I don't think it felt like part of history. Like I just felt like a part, like I was able to be a part of history, and I don't think it will.
It is history.
Yeah, it is history, and I just don't think that, you know, that's there's so rare that we get a chance to do that. So I think, yeah, like I say, it's gonna be. I'm gonna hold it in my heart for a very long time.
Those moments are perhaps also what makes it all the more worth it, and gives reason to, you know, keep fighting against the institutions that don't seem interested in displaying these movies, because they, when they do get out there, the impact it has. I mean, it, as you said, it's historical. If somebody's listening and they think, hey, this might be for me, what kind of questions should they ask themselves?
Oh my God. I really think that everybody can do it. I think the more voices we have in this space, I think for a long time, film has been positioned, programmed, curated by a very small pool of people. I think arguably, I think it still is, like the creative directors of the world and these, like, you know, these big major film critics and film programmers who kind of define what films are perceived to be better than others and various things like that. But I think the only the questions you need to ask about is why, thinking about what, why you want it, if you feel yourself wanting to put on certain films or like put films together, thinking about where that's coming from, thinking about what it is that you want to say, and yeah, what, like why you're doing it. Because again, go back, like for me, audiences are at the center of everything I do. So it, like, thinking for me, I think curation can often, for some people, be quite like a self-indulgent process, that like sits quite isolated from particular audience. People put packages together or you know, curate programs that don't necessarily have a specific audience in mind. And I think, like, why? Why have you done that? Like, I know that maybe you're interested in that as a programmer, but unless you can like connect that to why a specific audience might be interested or like, you know, these still, you're like offering audiences access to something that they maybe haven't had access to before. If you have a really deep interest in film and you think that you're, for example, you don't see the kind of work that you want to see like available to watch, or you work with or like are part of a community that you feel want to see certain things that aren't out there, or like that could offer a unique perspective on a film or like a group of films, then I think, you know, do it. Like I think it's one of these spaces that there's a lot of like opacity around it. Like people purposely make it out like this really like complicated, exclusive like space. And there are some technical things, but I think those are really simple things. And some of the work that I do, like I do a lot of like training around curation and programming as part of the company that I work for called Aya Films. We developed a training app that breaks down the like sort of more like practical elements of what's involved in curation. Because I think that once those are out in the world and more accessible to more people, I think the film curation and film programming will become so much more exciting. Just the very small few cohorts of curators that have gone through the program that I've been, you know, that I've been able to, that I've guided through the program. The programs that they've come out the other side have been like over, like so incredible. And so like new and fresh and exciting. And all it took was like making those like more, like I say, more practical elements, like less, more accessible to them. And we as like mentors and whatever it is that you would call us, kind of guiding that process, we didn't provide any input on terms of like what they curated, what like themes they were doing. All of that was just like there already. And I think for so many people, they have that there. It's just, again, it's that like, what do I do now? Like, what's the actual process of like getting the rights to a film, or like what's all this administrative stuff that's behind actually making this idea become a reality? So I think it's like not being intimidated by those and knowing that they are accessible, and like maybe finding out who's in your around you that might be able to make those processes more accessible to you. But in terms of the curation of it all, I think as long as you know why you're doing something and who you're doing it for, and you feel like confident and you feel like that's like sort of both of those like meaningful and you're doing something meaningful with that work, then I feel like anybody can do it. I don't think you need necessarily to have like a particular set of skills, whatever it is, you can learn. If people, if they wanted to get into curation, is to think about what is most readily available to them in their immediate environment. Like, who is there, like, you know, can you start like a film group in your local area? Like, you know, is there like a space near you that is already doing something, maybe has a film club already, or like has film, you know, facilities that you could like screen there? Like, what can you do in the immediate in your own surroundings with people and find a community around you to that's already doing that or is interested in doing that as well and can support you in that? Because I think I'm really like all for like deinstitutionalizing. I don't think we should necessarily always be looking to these big institutions for these jobs. I think you can learn so much more on, you know, on a grassroots like community level, and it's also much more accessible and you can just start like get, you know, just doing it, even if it's like, I don't know, like inviting people around to your house for a film night and just screening it in your own apart, you know, in your own place, and thinking and curating it in that sense and like writing, you know, writing stuff about films and all of that in that context and kind of building up. Because on a small level, in, you know, there is like regional like funding available for like community-led like screening and curation and programming. For example, there's like an organization called Cinema for All where you can like hire, you know, pop-up cinema equipment, for example, for like very, very cheap for like to run community screenings. I think to me that's like starting there, or at least doing that alongside perhaps trying to, you know, get into a festival or whatever institution there is. And again, speaking to what I was saying before, I think that the reality is it's not something, and this is why I don't want to like suggest that as the only route, is that if you're going into, if you have no experience, but also even if you do, even if you have like a master's in film curation, the reality is you're probably going to end up starting as like a volunteer in a film festival, which, yes, objectively, like is an incredible experience to become immersed in a film festival. You meet those people, you have access to lots of films, but you will be working for free, and therefore it's not an accessible route for so many people who are not just able to give all of their time for no money because they have to pay their bills and pay their rent. So those options are available as well. And I think, again, and this is a detriment to our industry, often the reason why these roles are not advertised is because they go to people that are within the sort of like are orbiting an organization already. So people that have already been volunteers often sort of just like move up into other roles. Other heads of programming meet people at other film festivals, you know, that have specific expertise in certain types of films or are interested in certain types of films, end up, you know, inviting them to be a programmer for their next festival. So like, you know, it's very incestuous, which is a real problem because again, it's like a real issue with accessibility. But I'm hopeful, and maybe just because I'm feeling like so like burn it all down, like that you know, that the industry is like that's like unsustainable in terms of like what audiences want, but also in terms of like we're seeing huge institutions, like for example, like happened here in Edinburgh, you know, like crumble, like they're so precarious now, even these huge institutions. And I think that grassroots, like community based level organizations are actually ironically perhaps better set up for like, you know, for what's coming for our industry, you know, which is like less money from, you know, less government funding, you know, like less people are going to cinema, like our industry is in crisis. And I think if you're thinking in your immediate surroundings and you're speaking to an audience and you're cultivating a very specific, you know, and you're working on a community level, I think firstly you learn more and it's better for your craft as a curator, as a programmer, but also I think hopefully it's like responding to a trend that's happening in our industry anyway, of like moving out of like all the money and all the resources and all the kind of spotlight going on these huge institutions.
All right, I think we should move on to some recommendations, because obviously that is kind of your job. I've kind of categorized them as recommendations, but really they're just movies that have meant something to you. And it doesn't have to be something that will appeal to everybody. So my first question is a movie or show, because, you know, the medium is fluid, that has inspired you? Can be a monumental inspiration or something recently.
A film that comes to mind is a documentary. It's a documentary called Hale County This Morning, This Evening by a filmmaker called Ramel Ross. It was really formative in terms of what I understood. Like, it really expanded my view of like what documentary could be. I think for a very long time, especially in relation to like blackness, black people, the way they've been presented in factual content, like news, but also in documentary, has really like, and this is like something I could talk about forever, so I'm going to try and talk about it really small. But I think it's like documentary, I think, is like literally central. It was central to the colonial project in terms of like how it justified the way that that the British Empire, the other empires, treated black people, because it was used as like a form of propaganda and brainwashing to not be hyperbolic, because it kind of created this like black subject that was like that justified the entire colonial project. So I think, and that's like still a legacy, I think, that sits in the way the documentary is now, even to this day, the way that it claims like an authority, especially like this like Voice of God documentary, which is like very much how documentary still, the former documentary still like in Britain, this like, you know, talking to camera, no shade to David Attenborough, but like very much in the David Attenborough, like I'm telling you a fact and this is truth, like this is reality, whether or not like what I'm talking about is my own lived experience or like, you know, has all these like problematic history and power dynamics. For a long time, the documentary form, even though I was like sort of attracted to it and interested in it, was like really problematic in terms of how it presented realities that are close to my own lived experience. And this film is like so incredible. Like, it was just sort of a life-changing experience watching it. The way that it, you know, it still claims, you know, like an association with real and reality, but it's so poetic, it's so dreamlike, it's so beautiful and tender and caring, the way that it presents people in this place, this place that it presents on screen. And it's so much closer to how I not only experience reality as a black person, the person that identifies as black, but also like just how we experience the world, because we don't experience the world in like binaries or in like concreteness. You know, like everybody experiences the world subjectively. Like, we're all sort of, you know, if we were both in one moment and we both experienced or watched something happen and we went and described it to other people, we would describe it in completely different ways, which to do with so many different factors, you know, not only to do with the environment, but also where we were coming from, how we were feeling that day, like what things might like resonate with us because of like our past or what we are attracted to or whatever. So I think, you know, like reality is like this sort of like subjective sort of like dream like thing that you sort of like float through. And I think this film like invites you to have multiple understandings. It invites you to like linger on other moments and not others, and kind of be more like an agent in the understanding of the film. It's just magical. And it's still, you know, it still is like, it's more, you know, captivating and holds your attention. And it, you know, it was hugely like, you know, hugely critically acclaimed, and people responded to it incredibly. But it was just doing something like so interesting with the form. It restored my faith in like what documentary could be, and it made me excited for what documentary is going to continue developing into be. And that kind of really expanded my like imagination as a curator in terms of what you can put in front of audiences and what they'll respond to. Yeah, it's a very good film. I'd recommend it. I think it's on Amazon Prime if anyone wants to watch it.
That's a good one. Yeah. Mhm. Mhm. And then a guilty pleasure.
I have to think about this. I don't know. Guilt is like such an interesting word for me, because I think that like we're made to certain like genres, for example, are like positioned to make us feel like they're less. Got less value than others, and that therefore we should feel guilty about watching them. And it's often like stuff that's popular, so like pop music or like popular films, and like, you know, Like, I just think if they're popular, if they're resonating with so many people, like, how can we, I don't know, how can they have less value than, like, these really niche things that, like, people, like, this high art stuff that women to be told is, like, the best. Like, but it doesn't resonate with, like, the masses. So I think, yeah, Guilty is an interesting one. But I think something that I feel like a very sort of like feeling when I'm watching, there's this like weird obsession that we've got now in like in pop culture, I think, with like rich people, that I don't really watch a lot of television or like literally a lot of other stuff that isn't to do with my job. But I watch Succession, and I also am obsessed with White Lotus. And I think for me, they go against what I want to be interested in, because like I don't want to be interested in like rich people and wealth. But it's like this weird, I think, and it's a testament to how they're made, because it's not that like way that we're used to seeing wealth, where this is being positioned as something that we should be aspiring to have. It's like this sort of like obscurity, and like, and it gets on you this like this real visceral feeling of like how horrid it is and how horrid these people are and like the absurdity of it all, that I find, yeah, it's like sort of like watching Aliens. And I do feel like something that maybe I would call guilt, but something very strange when I watch it, but I can't like look away. And I think that they're both the two incredible shows, but they are sort of like, it's like a weird, not guilty pleasure, but a weird sort of like morbid, I don't know, just this gross like feeling of like, oh, I'm getting some sort of delight out of watching real like horrible people and people that you know and conversations that you know. They're not alien, they are these people, this is something that people are doing, and it has like sort of like huge effects on the world, and these people are like running our country, they're running society. So there is like a sadness that comes with that, and like I shouldn't be enjoying watching it, but there is this weird pleasure that comes out of watching it. But it's really funny, I think it's really interesting, I hope someone writes about it. I think people probably have this, like, particularly why at this moment these stories that like really resonate with me, these like obscure stories of like wealth.
No, that's it's interesting how they cluster as well, you know. And then I'd like to hear about a movie that you love to experience for the first time again.
It's just like trying to think back to a time where I haven't watched a million films. I'm trying to count the films. This is like I'm assuming you're not going to use it. I'm trying to count the films I've watched this year. I think I've probably watched about 500.
Oh,
and it's just like trying to sift through those of like, when was the time when I watched films for just for pleasure? what film? Oh, I know which film. And it's, well, a film. A film that I think, and I think maybe it's just because I just watched the second one like 2 days ago. The first Black Panther film. I think thinking about audiences, I worked for cinema, and maybe I shouldn't say what cinema because they might get in trouble for having done this. But obviously, like Disney, like and Marvel, like have these huge like secrecy around films. Like most of the time, like people who work on the movies don't even watch it till the world premiere. So like, you know, you don't even get to see it. Like even as an exhibitor, if you're going to like help with the marketing, you don't get to watch it. It's like it's very, yeah, it's like this whole thing. But anyway, I worked in a cinema a while back, and they get sent like the DCP, like maybe like midnight, the night before it goes, it's playing the next day. So they had it in, and they put on a staff screening at like midnight before it was due to go out in the cinema. So we watched it as, you know, like a staff in the cinema. We had a huge the whole auditorium just to kind of ask more members of staff. And one of my best friends, Naomi, we've been waiting for this, we anticipated this forever. And I think there was just something about, yeah, watching it for the first time. Firstly, just the impact it had on us as a group was just amazing. It's like such an audience film. I think, again, it's one of these things, Marvel films, for all the problematics of these big studios, I think, again, it's like something that was always like, these big studio, these superhero films are often like, you know, like sidelined instead of, well, you know, they're just superhero films. But it was like such, it was like, you know, it was a kind of cultural moment, that first film, and such an emotional and visceral experience for me as an audience member. I hadn't quite got into like sort of film curation at that point, but I think about that experience, and I think I so rarely now and it's the one downside, I guess, of working in film. I watch a lot of films, but I'm also so rarely like an audience member in a cinema watching something for the first time just for the experience of watching it, just because I wanted to go see it. Like, I think, say, like 98% of the films, even if when I go see them in the cinema, it's because I've, like, some critic of mine has told me I should go see it, or I have to go watch it for work, or like I'm watching it in between other stuff and I'm not in the headspace. But it was really just like experience as an audience member, and it was so powerful. And me and my friend Naomi, who's also mixed race, identified as Black, like, we were just like, it was just like so crazy. And I think now, like, everything that's happened, you know, with the passing of Chadwick Boseman in this, like, and the watching the second film, I was taken back to that moment. And I don't think really actually that I'll ever have an experience like that as an audience member watching a film for the first time again. And I watch it all the time again, especially with my friend Naomi. And I think it's like trying to recapture that moment of watching it for the first time. And I think that's such an incredible thing about cinema and the anticipation. Yeah, just like watching a film that you've been waiting to come out, and that's so meaningful for you personally, but also for like so many people globally. You feel like it's you in that moment, or it's just me and Naomi in that moment, but you feel through watching it like part of this like real like mass like of group of people. Like, through watching it, you feel like you're part of this like huge community, and it's something that's so rarely happens, even with film. But it's something that's very, very specific to film, I think.
And this is always an incredibly hard question to answer, but I would like to know if there's a woman in this industry, whether that's a fellow curator or a filmmaker, that inspires you, who you'd like to give a shout out to.
I really hope she's listening, because it'll just be funny. So hi, Isra, if you're interested. But yeah, someone that inspires me and is also a close friend of mine and is also a curator, Isra Al Kafi, who is one of the founders of Tape Collective, the curation and programming collective, film exhibition collective. There are people in this industry who I think people don't appreciate, like the extent to which they could they're like working in the background, and how the like breadth of their skills. And I think Isra, but also Tape Collective in general, I think what the work that they do is like makes me feel hopeful about the future of the industry. But at the same time, it's just an organization that people, you just wish someone would just give a huge amount of funding to, and they would just take over the world. Like, that's literally there's people in the industry that, you know, the only limit is resources. That's it. And there's like nothing that they wouldn't be able to achieve. And I think Isra is testament to that. And what she achieves and what they achieve as an organization with the resources that they have is you know, and the audiences that they create work for, and the care and the time that goes into the work that they do, is just like unparalleled, really. The audiences know that, but I think as an industry, like, I don't think people quite appreciate what it takes to do that work and how skilled they are and how skilled she is, because we're talking about one person. You know, she could like run a venue, like she knows how like venues work, like curation, audiences, like distribution. It's just like, yeah, it's just astonishing. And I think there's people, you know, people do appreciate, people know. You know, Tape are like, you know, held in high regard. But I think I'm just so humbled by and just inspired by everything that they do.
Amazing.
So hi, it's really good listening.
Thank you so much for this conversation, Carmen. Thank you for opening up and telling me about all of these impressionable moments and the work that you do. For people who'd like to see more of you and you know, follow what you do, where should they go? What do you want to plug and promote?
Where should they go? I'm on Twitter and Instagram. I would warn everybody that Instagram, I do post a lot of pictures of my dog. Do you be prepared for that?
I don't think that's a warning.
Film stuff. I'm wrapping up a lot of projects at the moment, because it's the end of the year. But I obviously do a lot of work with We Are Parable, so I would encourage you not just to look at my work, but also just to look at the work that they do. If you're not aware of the work that they do, which is UK wide, so it's not, you know, even if you're outside of London. I'd keep an eye on their social media channels as well. But Gravedigger's Wife is still at the cinemas. yeah, if you haven't seen it and you want to support an incredible independent film, go and see it at cinema near you. Yeah, I think that's it.
Great.
But yeah, I'm on all the like normal social media mm-hmm. channels. Yeah. I think I'd like everybody not really moving away from Twitter, but it's that thing of like,
we'll see if it exists, you know, by the time this goes up. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine. yeah, and just like, at, you know, festivals and things. Like, it's a small world. So, especially if, you know, if anybody listening is like interested in curation or programming and sees me at a festival, come and ask me about it.
yeah, exactly. And then I'll let you have the last word. What do you want to tell our listeners?
I would just say, in general, go to your local independent cinema. Yeah, like I think a lot of people maybe don't realize they love independent film. You know, I know there's a cost of living crisis. For some people, it isn't possible to keep going to the cinema. And some I don't judge people that, for example, stream things illegally off the internet. Like, we've got to do what we've got to do. But if you have the means and within your capabilities, go out and support independent film, because it's, until we find another way of valuing and quantifying success of films, all that we have now is numbers. So like, put that film on Netflix, that independent film that maybe you don't even want to see, put it on in the background and stream it just so that it's played once. But even if you don't have time to go to cinema, but you do have money to go to cinema, buy a ticket to a film. You don't necessarily have to go see it. But also, if you do have the time and you want to go see a film, just go and see those independent films over that big Hollywood studio one that you can torrent online or will end up on Netflix, because people need the numbers to show that this film, it's kind of films that's worth making or that's worth supporting, and also for venues, it's films that are worth putting on for people to be able to see. So that's what I would say.
I feel like we should have a jingle for this. Do you agree?
Like, what kind of a jingle? Like, da 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 da. Like, when you're.
Like a round table.
Oh, yeah, like a choir.
The round table.
Not choir.
Round table.
Yeah. Well, anyway, there you go, folks. There's your jingle.
No, please don't put that in there. Please don't.
I was gonna do like a screamer one, like. Round table, but let's not do that either.
Oh no, that's even better. Just scream at them, like out of nowhere. The interview ends, they think they're done. Round table. Okay, well, I mean, I don't even know if we could call it a round table. We're just currently two people, but the idea is for two it to people. Be a round table with three people. Yeah. I'm, as always, your host, Evita.
And I'm Lauren.
Why should they care? Who are you?
They shouldn't. Right off of the bat, they shouldn't. So random, my monitor, really.
So, anyway, you just listened to my interview with Carmen Thompson, and I hope you really enjoyed it, because I did, and I just realized that I'm not recording on my phone.
I am.
So I'm going to go do that now. So for everyone listening, there's going to be a bit of a jump. And one, two, three. Now the audio should be better. Actually, before we get into our main topic of today's roundtable, I do want to make a quick correction. Because I mentioned when we're talking about early movies, I mentioned that I remember being in the parking lot after watching Babe. I don't remember watching Babe. And the reason I don't remember watching Babe is because I don't think I ever watched Babe, and I certainly was never in the parking lot after watching Babe, because it came out in 1995 and I'm born in 2002. Turns out the movie was Charlotte's Web, which makes a lot more sense since I was 4 years old. So I'm sorry to all of the pig movies for the confusion. I sincerely didn't mean to do it. It was Charlotte's Web, and I will make an effort to watch Babe when I can. So moving on from that correction, what we saw in this conversation, as well as our last interview with Corinna, is that the matter of representation is again so greatly needed, and internationally at that as well. Carmen's work is so heavily focused on bringing movies from Africa
into the UK and bringing them to audiences that haven't seen them before, bringing them to African audiences in the UK who have had access to them. Working on movies like The Gravedigger's Wife, which is the first Somali movie to ever be put out. Working on movies like Rafiki, which was a groundbreaking Kenyan movie about a queer, beautiful queer love story. And I remember watching that as well. And if we're just going to jump straight into it, we want to talk a bit more about representation, because we kind of touched on it in the last episode, but then we had to cut it a little bit short. I had to edit it down, and we want to get to some more points we've had in the meantime, because this is something that cannot be wrapped up in 10 or 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But the story between the two lead women and their relationship is incredibly beautiful. And love is something that we do not see represented enough. And it is one of those aspects where we can go from beyond just an identity itself, a description, and onto actual emotions. Moving on from the representation of an identity to a fully formed person, to their relationship with others, is an aspect that still needs to be explored, and I don't know what the right word is, but like found, because I don't think a lot of people,
yeah,
but you know what I mean, right? Like people, and I don't, okay, in defense of checklist diversity, people are getting hired, people are getting paid, people are coming on the screen, and they're getting credit so they can go on to something better. It sucks. It's not the best way to do it. But I would rather have checklist diversity than a fully white cast.
At least it's happening.
You know? So, like, at least, you know, some people, the actors, are getting... I mean, I'm just thinking for the actors.
It's like, what we can get, yeah.
At least they can, you know, get some money, you know? Like, it's... As long as people get paid, like, that's also very important to me. So, anyway, while you have checklist diversity, which isn't great, but I have my slight defense of it, there needs to be more focus on the, like, entirety of diversity and its relations with others. And you had some thoughts on that. So I'll let you take the...
Yeah.
Boat? I don't know. Wheel? Take the wheel.
Okay, the boat. I'm taking the boat. Right, so something that always kind of that I was thinking about recently, because it's on UK Netflix right now, is the movie Fools Russian, which so it stars Salma Hayek and Matthew Perry, and it's about a like white guy who lives in the US and he's like working, I think he's like a he develops like houses or something like that. I don't know. And he meets Salma Hayek, who's like this like really outgoing Mexican woman, and they basically fall in love because they hook up one night and she ends up pregnant and they get like married and together and whatnot. And what's really interesting is that like that's one of my dad's favorite movies, because my dad, an American, he came to work in Mexico City when he was working for AT&T. Met my mom, who is a really outgoing Mexican woman. So it's like, it was, he always just really liked that movie because it he felt like it was really close to his own relationship and it was just kind of close to home. And even though like their love story is just a little different, as we kind of talked about it last episode for some reason, I think it kind of got me thinking about how important it is for mixed race couples. When it comes to mixed race couples, like I think seeing themselves in film and seeing like their relationship and something similar like that develop in film, it's quite beautiful to see, because like you don't really think about that perspective, you know, of like two people falling in love, getting over a language barrier, getting over a cultural barrier. And it's honestly one of the most interesting things to see, is just like when people see well their relationship somewhere, you know, and it's represented nicely and they can identify with that. And I think about that like in like the POC version of this, like my mom, you know, like she has like her thoughts on it and everything, and she likes the movie as well because she also just identifies with like meeting a really like kind of introverted white man, and then she's just, you know, and I'm walking exclamation point, and it was just it also kind of hits a little home, close to home with her. And I think that when you think about it, like, in the perspective of the white person, usually, like, what I've seen is, like, in the American one, I think it really shows them, like, a completely different kind of window to romantic possibilities as well. Because, and I don't know who listens to these, so I think I'm just gonna just kind of go over this really quick. I know people that are my parents' age who were told by their parents that they couldn't date people of a specific race, and they never, that those people never really found anything wrong with that, you know, and they never understood why when they were younger. But I think, like, when you as a younger person don't see anything wrong with that and you're told not to do it, it kind of hurts you a little bit, you know, because it limits, like, your feelings, and it limits your, you know, what you can explore and not explore, right? So I think that seeing all these love stories and seeing how, even if it might be wrong, quote unquote wrong, it doesn't have to be, you know, like, you can do whatever you want if you want to. And sorry, this is kind of like all over the place,
so,
but
much stigma. Yeah.
It's just like, I think it's just really important to show that, because it's, I feel like a lot of people still don't allow it, if you know what I mean. Like, it's just, like, really weird that people still don't think that, like, that should be a thing.
Completely and wholeheartedly agree. Because, yeah, there's still, like, a lot of stigma, but it's not something that's talked about anymore, because the general consensus is it shouldn't be. But I feel like this still hasn't been done the work to kind of erase that.
Yeah. And I feel like a lot of the ones that I've seen, which are still important, are, like, these horrible films where, like, people of two different races fall in love and they have to, like, do so much to get over it, and one of them dies or something. And I know that that's true, like, that has happened before, especially, like, in the US and everything. But I feel like it's also nice just to see, like, films about, like, just really nice, wholehearted films about two people of different races falling in love, because I think that, like, you know, it's not always, like, suffering. Sometimes, like, the struggle is just, like I said, language barriers itself, you know, or, like, maybe one of them moves to a different country, you know, and they have to, like, adapt to that different country, and that's a whole different struggle, where then also, like, that representation is also needed, you know, where it's, like, what's it like for you to be coming from a completely different country to a new one where you don't speak the language, you don't know anything about it, you know? So I think it's just, there's a lot of different conversations when it comes to the science of representation in marriage. I've actually got a really good example of a different movie that isn't just Fool's Russian, which is just a rom-com. So there's that movie Belle, and it's a really nice movie because it was based off of real life, where it was the daughter of, well, not the daughter, actually, sorry, that's bad. The illegitimate daughter of a Navy admiral is trained and brought up by her aristocratic uncle and his wife. However, she is mixed race, so they kind of just have her there as, like, a companion to their actual niece, who's just, you know, a white girl. But eventually, obviously, they absolutely adore her, and they, you know, raise her up as a daughter and everything. And, but, you know, living in that century, there were, like, certain aspects where, like, they had her eating with, like, the help and everything, and so on and so forth. But it was actually, it's such a beautiful movie, because she was so intelligent, and she's, you know, talking about, like, this case about some cargo ship dumping slaves in the ocean and everything, and she falls in love with a lawyer who's, like, apprenticing for her uncle. And even though, like, it depicts the struggle of, like, a woman of mixed race back then courting, if you will, a white man, it's honestly one of the most romantic movies I've ever seen. Like, and I know this happened in, like, real life, I don't know how accurate it was, but, like, it was so beautiful. I mean, oh my god, like, it was just so great. And I think that that's, like, another really good example of, like, how these movies usually only depict, like, oh, we had to die in order for us to be together, you know, we were buried together in the end, and it's, like, that's so horrible, you know, like, I know that probably happened, but, you know, and, like, even though you know, back then the struggle to marry somebody who was any race different than yours, especially like mixed race, was absolutely, it was impossible to do. You know, they managed to do it and it was great. And then in the movie, like the way it depicted it, it, you know, it showed the struggle of it, but they were in love and it was freaking good at showing that, you know, it was a really romantic movie. And also Tom Felton is in it as some racist weirdo, like he's horrible in that, but he does it very well, I'll say that. Yeah, it's just like too well done, but oh, no. It's a great movie.
Yeah. Yeah, well, what do you think you want to see more of in terms of love stories?
I want to see I think of love stories definitely more queer ones as well, where it's not like
just a white blonde and brunette.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, why is it always that?
That's their diversity right there.
I'm like, my god,
I want to see two women like genuinely falling in love. And oh god, actually, okay, there's this movie called Summerland that I watched one day when I was cooking with my mom a gazillion months ago. And at first I was like, ooh, I don't want to watch this, but it's actually really good. It's got Gemma Arterton in it and Gugu Mbatha-Raw as well. And it's basically this recluse writer, like in World War II in some place in England. And obviously she gets like a kid sent to her because, you know, they were like sending kids away and everything. And she's like, ew, I don't want this kid. And they're like, well, you have to take care of it, you know, so suck it up. And she's like really bitter, really, really, really bitter because she was in love with a woman. And it's basically this whole thing. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but it's quite beautiful and it's queer and it's got two women, one of them being a person of color, not just a blonde and a brunette. So please watch Summerland. I cried so much. It was such a beautiful movie. Like, please go watch it. Anyway, so I think, like I said, I would love to see more like queer love stories. And I've said this before, I don't want porny lesbian movies. I refuse to watch any that have graphic sex scenes in it because like sometimes when you see like movies about gay men, they're not usually having graphic sex on screen as much as women are. And I think we all know like why that is. Like you said, just not a blonde and not a brunette anymore. Like we need more, just like a good salt, just a good, you know, well-rounded relationship. And then I think I would, because obviously what's really great about, you know, movies nowadays is that like obviously people have a bunch of mixed race couples on screen quite a bit, which is really good. I would love to see more like cross-hopping relationships just because I think that would be really fun. And I love that because I love the plot line of like, oh, I can't speak Italian or like just something dumb. Like, I love that. That's just me. That's just a personal preference. Like, oh no, like not Emily in Paris.
Sorry,
like,
that's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I want to see more of like, I love seeing bamboozled white men in other countries. I think it's great because I think it kind of like, I don't know, to me, it's just like, I think it makes the woman like seem better because I feel like constantly if it's like a white man and a woman of color, the white man is still smarter all the time. And it's like, no. So I think it's really nice when like they're in the other country.
And it's done in a tasteful way where they're not making fun of the new culture that they're facing.
Yeah, because, exactly.
There is definitely also a genre of mixed race romantic movies which are done so just because they want a little bit diversity, but they didn't want full diversity. I think it'd be nice to always see more mixed race couples where one party is not white, because you can have that, surprisingly.
No, sorry, that's just like
no, that wasn't you. I was just like, in general, I feel like people are mixed race, okay, one white person and then one somebody else, you know.
They're just so,
yeah, it's like, yeah, you don't have to do it like that. And like, I'm sure somebody's gonna bring up, what about fetishization? I think you can tell, like, exactly what we're talking about, like a lot of lesbian romantic movies directed by men. Oh lord.
Yeah.
You can tell, and those suck.
Yeah.
And they need to be eradicated because they're not doing anything either else, you know, like they're not, you know, like, okay, they might be bringing down stigma a little bit, I guess, but then they're creating like an interest in other people for the wrong reasons. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, are a lot of, like, who's watching those films more, women or men? And then you're like, that's a suspicious
yeah, and also for like you know yeah, why. And also for like other cultures, you know, where like Latino women and Asian women have been really fetishized, you know, in the media. So, but we need representation behind the scenes yes. to make that happen. Like, that's where it comes from. You see the issues when those movies come up, you look at who made yeah. them, and it's very apparent. Like, it's very, very easy to find yeah. out where the issue happened. And that's not to say that, you know, straight white men can't make good movies about other people's
It's just they're usually bad.
It's not to say that. But the majority of people who make movies like that, yeah, like, it's not to say that, you know, if you're listening and you do fall into that category and you do want to make an amazing queer POC love story, it doesn't say it can't do that, but you should involve yeah. queer yeah, POC people in it.
Yeah, I agree completely. Because it's really, that's all that really takes, you know. But actually, yeah, now that I think about it, like, the only, when it comes to, like, two people, like, two different POCs dating, there is just one white person there to, I guess, represent the entire white population. Like, I don't know what it's there for. Because, like, I mean, even me talking about it, the only examples I gave were that, because it's the only examples I can think of. There's this movie that I haven't seen, so, like, I don't even know what it's called. I don't even, we'll look into it. But I think it's also based on real life, where a white woman goes to Africa.
Does that sound? Sorry.
She dates. Yeah, exactly. And she is in Africa for some reason. And he was like the leader of like their group, but he was like a prince. And basically she lives there with them for a while. And she runs away with their daughter. And I can't remember what it's called, but I remember my mom saw it once.
Oh, is it Anna the King from 1999? Perhaps it looks. Anna, a teacher assigned to teach King Mongkut's children, finds her life changing when she falls in love with the king. Could that be it?
Yeah, that's the one. I haven't seen it yet either, but I know it's there because I was like looking at some of them.
Oh, and Tom Felton is in this one. Was that the one you were talking about?
He's in both. Well, I was just yeah. talking about Belle. Him, Tom Felton. Oh, being
that's
in
really weird. No, Anna. Leonovans, Jodie Foster, a British widow, has come to Siam with her son Louis, Tom Felton.
Oh, well, look at him. Range.
How do we wrap that up?
Well, representation matters. Love is beautiful.
Love is beautiful.
Representation
and more love.
I want to see people in love, okay? Love.
Love is important.
Yes.
Relationships are important. I don't know, it's probably just a phase that a lot of people go through, but I hated romance in movies growing up.
Same. It was so,
so much
disgusting.
So much. I hated it every single time. Like, I remember watching Wonder Woman and not even like, I was so, and when I came out, I was like, oh my god, it's so amazing, they weren't even together. And then I rewatched it and I was like, wait, they kissed? I didn't, like, I blocked it out. Yeah. Like, I was like, that didn't happen, because we need this, you know, like.
Yeah.
And I do think there needs to be relationships, like, specifically friendships between, like, men and women in movies.
Oh, yeah, just
that's
solid
just never there.
Friendship.
So I think that's where that...
Friendship, love.
Friendship, like, in Shang-Chi.
Oh, my God, freaking love Shang-Chi.
Love
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So friendships and relationships and, you know, platonic love
Ooh.
Needs to be in there as well.
Brotherly
we can
love.
Go into that another...
Right,
like,
I just had a really good
exactly.
movie. I can't remember what it's called. Hang on, I'm going so fast. Okay, Luis Gerardo Mendez is in this movie called Half Brothers. It came out in 2020. I don't know where you can watch it. I saw it in theaters a long time ago. But it's really cute. It's about a brother who... lives in Mexico. He doesn't talk to his dad because his dad left to go find work illegally in the US, and he finds out that the dad died or something, and he finds his half-brother, and they go through a cross-country Mexico US trip, and they are in love, like, because they're brothers, they love each other mm-hmm. so much, and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. I loved it more than anything. I cried so much. It was
I
great.
I love that. Yeah, and I was actually just thinking, you know, like, also, you know, I think what you will see when you have, like, diversity on screen is friendships. But you never really see, like, a friendship storyline. Like, I want a romantic movie about best friends. I want to see them become best friends. You don't have that. They are just best friends. Mm. And you don't, like,
you don't see that development. About, like,
you don't see the development. You don't see how they meet each other's, like, backgrounds and things like that at all. And I want to see that.
Yeah, because, like, for example, like, our friendship is so lovely, and it was so unlikely. And, like, even that is so nice. Yes. Like, if you think about it. I mean, I DM'd her a, I think, picture of Obama, Broccoli Obama. Like, it's just, no one talks about that in movies. It's, like, how wonderful friendships are. Yeah, sure, you can do anything with the power of friendship, but no one talks about how it gets there. And it's quite lovely, because it's just as, you know, endearing, it's just as heartwarming, and it can be just as thrilling as, like, and friggin' Pride and Prejudice. It's just...
Yeah, I don't know.
For life SD.
I need to find out if there is, like, an actual, like... And obviously you have, like, enemies to friends, but that's not the same.
Yeah.
I want, no, like... Not. I just want, like, a... I just want a movie written exactly like a love story, but about best friends. I just... I want that real bad. Yeah, platonic love is so important as well. It is just... And what I'm saying is not, like, that every single movie should be this or that. No, I'm saying we need, like, a very wide variety. Like, we need a diversity of diverse stories.
Experience.
So there's no mascots or anything like that. And that's how you also, like, get rid of stereotypes. So
Beverly Hills Chihuahua is a really good example of that as well.
Great.
Well, I stand by that. Yeah, that's what I'm here to give. It's just really niche movie recommendations.
Yes,
except
I love
Beverly Hills Chihuahua is quite well known. So. I need to stop.
Okay, so to wrap this up, I guess, have you been watching anything interesting that you want to talk about? I haven't watched anything since we last talked. I don't think I've watched a movie, which is really sad. I don't think... I'm watching Mythic Quest Season 3. Would highly recommend. It's really fun. It's about, like... video game developers.
Okay.
So they're developing this video game, and it has great representation, and I really, I think I might write something about this, but then the last thing I wrote was about how I hadn't written for, like, a year, and I haven't written anything since that, and that was, like, 3 months ago. So I don't know. I just thought that was really funny. But they have I love the women in there because they're so annoying and shitty and just, like, they're annoying people, but in the best way. And, like, they're not, like, likable all the time. Like, they will have likable traits. Like, you like them because they're good characters, but you would never want to be friends with them, like, ever. Except for, like, Dana, because she's, like, amazing. Love her. But, like... Yeah, a wide variety of annoyingness. Like, you have one of the developers, Poppy Lee, the main developer. She's played by Charlotte Nikdow. Yeah, in the show, like, she's a very particular developer. Like, she just is very obsessed with her craft, and she's incredibly annoying. She does not have social skills, and not in a cute and quirky way, in a way where it would be infuriating to interact with her in real life and work for her. But they also show, like, all these, like, creatives in power, and then they, like, will go to them talking with, like, the graphic designers being like, I've worked for 40 days straight, you know, like, please do not do this to me. And so you see these characters, which you like. They're funny. It's a comedy. You know, you're laughing along with them. But then you realize if you were actually in the situation, it would be hell. And also, this is the situation for so many creatives out there, whether it is in video games, in writing, in filmmaking. Like, this is the thing where you will have geniuses and their genius ideas. And then, my God, the people who are actually making that happen are suffering because of it.
I feel like that's a good example. I've been thinking about Hans Zimmer quite a bit. He cannot be writing all of those pieces himself. I know we all know this, but I never know who is. And I'm always like, oh God, I love Hans Zimmer. Like, I just, like, eat his music. And is it really his? Is
he, like when you're doing so much, like, how do you really do it? Like,
yeah, like James Patterson. Why does he write so many books?
Like Elon Musk. Why is the CEO of, like, three companies?
Yeah.
And if they're still, like, intact, surely he doesn't do anything, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But it's like, who is? Like, who are these people? Like, I know Hans Zimmer just walks into the studio and goes, I want Pirate Song. And they're like, okay, Pirate Song. You know, like, I know that that's probably what that's like.
Ghostwriter. Oh, yeah.
No, I wouldn't be. I would die. I would kill myself if everyone was like, oh, I love Hans Zimmer. Prince of Egypt was so freaking good.
I love Shark Tale. And I'm just like,
yeah. I always forget about Shark Tale, dude. I block that. Right. Yeah.
But anyway, I've just been watching Mythic Quest. That is the only thing, like, new thing that I can mention since last episode. Yeah, it's good. You should all watch it. It's an Apple TV show, so watch it where you can. Wink, wink.
Because we were talking about diversity last week, I went ahead and watched Spanglish with Adam Sandler, which I think is, like, one of the most normal movies he's been in. That's just, you know, and Spanglish is an excellent example of this entire conversation, so go watch Spanglish, or I will find you and force you to watch it. It's beautiful. It's about an immigrant mother, and it's kind of in the point of view of her daughter, who, like, grows up, and she's writing, I think, her college essay, which is, like, so slay of her, using that situation for that. And her mom cleans houses, you know, Adam Sandler's a chef. You think they're going to end up together, but they don't, and that's actually quite nice. But obviously, there's, like, a big language barrier. It's beautiful. I love it with my whole heart. I forgot to talk about it last week, but it is a fantastic example of this week's conversation. So please go watch it.
Amazing. Now. I do love love stories as well, where they don't meet up with each other, like, or don't end up with each other.
Actually, I don't like that.
I mean, it's excruciating, but I think it's, like, the great story. Yeah, but I don't like story. That pain. Like, I wish that's what they'd done with When Harry Met Sally, but they didn't do that because they were...
No, yeah, because, no, no, I disagree. I have to disagree with that. Because I will kill myself if they don't. Like in Wonder Woman, we don't talk about the second movie, but, like, the first movie, like, no, that was too much for me. That was too much, that they weren't in love forever.
Oh, I loved that, though. Like, I loved it so much, I erased the parts that were there.
No.
Well, it's been great talking with you, Lauren.
You're welcome.
Great. Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Making It Women in Film, a podcast produced by Bonnie and Braw and LS Films. If you want to support this podcast, you can do so by subscribing to us wherever you're listening and leave a review or a rating. It'll only take you a few clicks, but it'll mean the world to us. You can also check out our website, womeninfilm.co.uk, follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram at makingwomeninfilm, and feel free to shoot us an email at makingwomeninfilm@gmail.com if you have any questions or inquiries or anything at all, and we'll try to get back to you. Alright, I guess I'll just see you next week. Bye!